Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an article about the Grateful Dead 60 years ago. And in June 1963, girl groups take over. And a classic album review of Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline. And here's the article about the Grateful Dead titled From Here to Eternity. 60 years ago, the Grateful Dead embarked on a mission that would freak out label bosses, exasperate producers, and turn on millions to the infinite possibilities of improvised psychedelic rock. David Frick heads back to 1960 San Francisco and uncovers the method and madness behind the band's wildest musical phase. The Grateful Dead is an anarchy. Their accomplices reveal, and that was good and bad. The letter was dated December 27, 1967, on the official stationery of Warner Brothers Records president Joe Smith, addressed to Danny Ritkin, co-manager of the label's biggest investment in the San Francisco scene, the Grateful Dead. Smith was not happy. Lack of preparation, direction, and cooperation from the very beginning have made this album the most unreasonable project with which we have ever involved ourselves, Smith wrote of the chaos around the Dead's second LP. Less than half done after 2 months at four studios in Los Angeles and New York. Producer Dave Hassinger, who engineered top five albums by the Rolling Stones and Jefferson Airplane, had quit, fed up with the Dead's combative manner. Nobody in your organization has enough influence over Phil Lish to invoke anything resembling normal behavior, Smith complained to Rifkin, referring to the Dead's cerebral, iron-willed bassist. Half of the Turmoil's leading wedge with guitarist Jerry Garcia. It was an inevitable clash of wills in a business overturned by the Beatles. Lavish milestone, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The Dead's deal with Warner Brothers, signed in autumn 1966, ensured Garcia, Lesh, guitarist Bob Ware, organist Ron Pigpen McKernan, and drummer Bill Kurtzman, full artistic control and unlimited studio time. Hassinger, hired for their debut album, ignored that, producing The Grateful Dead in 4 days. Nervous and speeding on Dexamol, a diet medication, the Bay Area's hottest improvising dance band zipped through a typical set list of folk and blues covers in brittle, mostly 3-minute blasts. Aside from a 1965 demo session at the Emergency Crew and a 66 single for an obscure local imprint, we had no real record consciousness, Garcia admitted to Rolling Stone in 1972. The Grateful Dead, issued in March 1967, was simply what we were doing on stage, played way too fast. It was weird, and we realized it. The band's original concept, Garcia confessed in another interview, was unreasonable. One LP, two sides, one song. Closer to the LSD-assisted infinity the Dead sought in performance. pursuing collective transcendence in the R&B and Delta fundamentals of Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour, and the Cannon's jug stomper, Viola Lee Blues. It was a combination of mistake, fate, and faith, Weir said, looking back in 2009. We learn to trust ourselves and each other while serving the audience. Our job was to find the beat and get people dancing. The second album would go, as Garcia put it, that whole other way. In September 1967, as recording commenced in L.A., the guitarist confided his plan for the Dead's enduring portrait of the ballroom experience in San Francisco's brief season of acid, license, and community, 1968's Anthem of the Sun. We're thinking of doing parts of the next album live, he told jazz critic Frank Kofsky. We're also gonna try doing stuff with combining live and studio. The band had some nice heavy material and good ideas. This time, Garcia warned, we're gonna go in and fuck around. That's all they did at first, accomplishing absolutely nothing in L.A., Garcia said, then driving Hassinger around the bend in New York. We were being so weird, Garcia noted generously. The producer was only human after all. The Dead were now a fiercely polyrhythmic force, adding a second drummer, Brooklyn-born Mickey Hart, after he met Kreutzmann at a Count Basie show. And the two locked like brothers during a Dead gig in late September 1967. This was a newly assertive band of composers, too, recording entirely original material for Anthem, even as it evolved in shape and detail on stage. That's It for the Other One was a wildly swerving multi-part suite with a churning staccato sentry inspired by the Yardbirds' Little Games. Here's a little bit of that song, That's It for the Other One, by the Grateful Dead. Garcia described New Potato Caboose to journalist Ralph J. Gleason as a very long thing, without verse-chorus form, but plenty of fast, difficult transitions. Garcia persuaded Robert Hunter, a poet friend from their teenage years in Palo Alto, to contribute lyrics. In the early 1960s, the two played folk and bluegrass and coffee house combos, and Hunter's reports from his 1962 participation in an LSD research program at Stanford University inspired his friend to go tripping. Fittingly, Dark Star, Hunter's first crucial submission to the Dead, was a compact rapture in luxuriant Gallic metaphor. Recorded as a single in New York, it immediately took on light-year dimensions in live improvisations. And here's a little bit of that song, Dark Star, by the Grateful Dead.
Searchlight casting for faults in the clouds of delusion. Shall we go?
What we were up to in Dark Star was the grit Weir claimed in 2005. It had contour every night. We'd try to get to the same realms within the tune. But it was also different every night when we got there. In 2014, Lesh likened the Dead in Free Flight to John Coltrane's mid-60s quartet, where they would play out on those modes, one root, but there is so much in there. A classically trained trumpeter who studied modern composition at Mills College in Oakland, Lesh introduced another key disruptive element, pianist Tom Constantine, his roommate at Mills. Serving in the U.S. Air Force, stationed in Las Vegas, Constantine took leave to join the anthem Bedlam as an avant-garde handyman, he says today. Constantine believes his jolts of surrealism, prepared piano electronic tape manipulation, were the beginning of the end for Hassinger. I'm proud to have contributed to that. The tipping point came in New York over Ware's request for Thick Air in Born Cross-Eyed, a two-minute uproar of shifting tempos, shrieks of guitar, and Lesh's mariachi trumpet. What Ware wanted but couldn't articulate, as he recalled in Playing in the Band, a dead oral history, was a little bit of white noise and compression, like the buzzing you hear in your ears on a hot, sticky summer day. Hassinger didn't hang around to figure it out. The Dead were now in charge. Overdubbing and mixing went into the spring of 1968 in three more studios as Garcia, Lesh, and the band's live sound engineer, Dan Healy, drew passages from 3 months of concert tapes for Anthem's brash alchemy of raw craft, stage impulse, and music concrete. The Dead found time as well to reply to Joe Smith's letter, returning it with a message scrawled sideways in big block letters. Fuck you. Promoter Bill Graham, a lifelong friend of the Dead, summed up their music and mission in a sign posted outside San Francisco's Winterland when the band headlined the venue's closing night. New Year's Eve, 1978. They're not the best at what they do. They're the only ones that do what they do. In their 60th year, the surviving members continue to do whatever that is. After 6 months working in clubs as the Warlocks, the Grateful Dead played their first official show under that name at Graham's Fillmore Auditorium on December 10th, 1965. The group formally disbanded 30 years later after Garcia's death of a heart attack in drug rehab in August 1995. He was 53. The music never stopped, just as the Dead carried on from the 1973 loss of McKernan to alcohol-related liver disease and keyboardist Brent Mylands' fatal drug overdose in 1990, Ware, Lesh, Hart, and Kruseman toured and recorded with separate projects and in states of reunion. Prospects for a 60th birthday event ended with Lesh's passing in October 2024 at 84, but Ware and Hart were in Las Vegas this spring with Dead and Company, and Ware brings his group, the Wolf Brothers, to Britain this summer. Meanwhile, in the massive box set tradition of 2011's Europe 72, the complete recordings, 73 CDs, and 2015's 30 Trips Around the Sun, 80 CDs. Enjoying the Ride, released on May 30th, is 60 discs of gigs from Deadhead shrines such as the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, Red Rocks in Colorado, and the Fillmore West. The last is represented by three nights of psychedelic prime time in June 1969, 2 weeks before the release of the Dead's third album. AOXOMOXOA, a pioneer in cosmic Americana, as confounding in its execution as its palindromic title, coined by cover artist Rick Griffin. That LP was nearly the end of the ride. Recording took 6 months and drove the Dead into perilous debt to Warner Brothers. And for a couple of weeks in October 1968, Ware and McKernan were fired. The Dead tried it without them, says the band's archivist and reissue producer, David Lemieux. There are studio sessions of the Dead playing with another couple of guitar players trying things out, but it didn't last long. The Grateful Dead were an improbable alliance from the start, forged in a post-beat San Francisco of folk purism and impatient electricity, a Greenwich Village West itching to be a California Liverpool. In 1964, Garcia was a discharged Army veteran teaching guitar and banjo at a music store in Palo Alto. Despite lacking two joints on his right middle finger, thanks to a wood-chopping accident as a child, Ware, a teenage tearaway from a wealthy adoptive family, and Kreutzmann, drummer in a local R&B band, frequented the store. McKernan was born to rebellion, the son of a white R&B DJ. Self-taught on piano and harmonica, he wore biker gear, as untidy as his Peanuts nickname implied. He worked at the store with Garcia, playing with him and Ware in a jug band, and in late 1964 suggested a rock group was in order. We got our first gigs because we were a blues-oriented Rolling Stones-style band, Garcia said, of the ensuing combo, the Warlocks. And they were something else, too. The son of the music store's owner was on bass when Lech saw the Warlocks at Magoo's, a Menlo Park pizza joint, in May 1965. It was the sheer, raw, exhilarating sound of it, Lech told me in 2014, beaming at the memory. It was like I could swim in it. The next thing that happened was Garcia sat me down and said, "Hey man, I want you to play bass in this band." Lech had never played bass before. Garcia didn't care. They were mutually impressed on first meeting in 1962. Lech, by Garcia's guitar prowess in the folk clubs, Garcia, by Lech's intellect and music curiosity. Lech took to bass like he was doing Bach, precisely articulated notes in endless stair-step variations on any given melody. As an electric guitarist, Garcia combined bluegrass picking with a skidding tone and sustain that evoked his pedal steel guitar idol Ralph Mooney from Buck Owens Buckaroos. Peter Grant, who played pedal steel on AOXOMOAXO, had banjo lessons from Garcia in 1964. "He was showing me pedal steel stuff on banjo," Grant says, "and listened to Beat It On Down the Line, on The Grateful Dead. The first three quarters of the solo is like a pedal steel break. And here's a little bit of that song, Beat It On Down the Line, from The Grateful Dead. Never just a rhythm guitarist, Ware was a moving elliptical factor in between the lead and the bass, as he described it. Intuing where the hell they're gonna go and being there, Kritzman was the rhythm of the earth. Hart told Rolling Stone in 1969, Bill feels that to me. I play off it, and he responds. When we're into it, it's like a drummer with two minds, eight arms, and one soul. McKernan was the Dead's blues conscience, the original frontman on vocals, and a sweet, mellow guy, according to Letch. Except when he was up there, honking into that microphone. McKernan's death at 27 profoundly affected Garcia. Jerry was a little intimidated, Letch said, because he knew he had to be the guy now. And that was never his trip. He never wanted to be the guy. He devolved upon it. Dan Healy was a young engineer at a studio specializing in advertising jingles, living in a houseboat on San Francisco Bay next to Quicksilver Messenger Service, when he saw the Dead for the first time at the Fillmore in the summer of 1966. It was a lucky break for the Dead on a bill with Quicksilver. Letch suffered a fried amplifier during the set. Healy got it working. John ratted me out, Healy says, laughing, of Quicksilver guitarist John Cipiola. None of the bands had any money to buy strings or take an amp to a repair shop. I knew how to fix stuff. Healy was not impressed by the din coming through the PA. I was accustomed to the studio, having control over the sound, he explains. Pig pens singing. I couldn't understand a word. He was this gurgling noise. Healy had an epiphany. Recreate the studio on an audience-wide scale, so everybody could hear the music. That became a lifelong trip. The Dead had parted with Augustus Owley Stanley III, a.k.a. Bear, their first soundman and main source of top-shelf LSD. Healy got on the deck, serving in different eras into the 1990s. Anthem of the Sun was his trial by fire, effectively banned from any sensible recording facility in L.A. or New York. Healy and the Dead went into Columbus Recorders, a San Francisco space with the unfinished 8-track master of Side 1 and no music for Side 2, Healy says. They didn't have songs to record. To make up the difference, Healy took a 4-track stereo recorder on the Dead's winter 68 road trip up to the Pacific Northwest, back home for Valentine's Day at the Carousel Ballroom, and to Lake Tahoe for a stand at King's Beach Bowl, a bowling alley. From that stash came the guts of Side 2 Blur, combining Alligator, a cosmic blues with Hunter McKernan lyrics, and the chugging minimalism of Caution, Do Not Stop on Tracks, one of the Emergency Crew demos. The origin of the latter depends on the teller. Ware remembered hearing Them's 1965 Sumatic blues single Mystic Eyes on the radio and a group exclamation, "Check this out, we can do this." In his 2005 memoir, Letch described a train ride to gigs in Vancouver in July 1966. He and Kurtzman, entranced by the rhythm of the wheels clickety-clacking over the wheels in the rails. Caution, Letch wrote, was one of our simplest yet farthest-reaching musical explorations, one chord played at a blistering tempo. And here's a little bit of that song, Caution, by the Grateful Dead.
I went down one day. I went down to see a gypsy woman just one old day. Yes, I did. My baby, we ain't been getting down like we used to do.
Most accounts, it seems, are true. The demo was a virtual Xerox of Them's record. But in concert across 1966 and 67, Caution took off like a ride without end, paired with Alligator in a remarkable prophecy of krautrock pulse and 70s Afrobeat with blues band Fury and McKinnon's Hobo Shaman singing. The title, From the Signs at Railroad Crossings, was deliberate. Caution, Ware noted, was anything but what the tune was about. The prevailing mystery of Anthem is what came from where they kept building on this master 8-track recording. Lemieux says, they brought that to different studios and added to it. The call response of fuzz guitar and kazoos in Alligator, the eerie underwater treatment of Garcia's vocal in the Martyr's Ballad, cryptical envelopment rigged by Healy with the Leslie speaker from a Hammond organ. The King's Beach tapes were heavily relied upon for Alligator and Caution, Lemieux notes. But you can hear things from the carousel, such as McKernan's exhortation as the drums roll in Alligator. Come on, everybody, get up and dance. It won't ruin ya. We were assembling a stained glass window, Constantine observes, a dogged piecemeal approach documented in an extraordinary artifact. Letch's handwritten mix breakdown on yellow legal tablet paper of everything over each LP side on the master tape. There are sketchy references to source material, but one notation for the other one confirms excerpts from King's Beach, a show in Eureka, California, and two nights in Portland, Oregon, spread across the 8 tracks at the same moment. For the edits, Healy often held his thumb on the tape machine's flywheel to get live reels from different gigs in sync at matching speed. I've always felt it was Phil's idea, Healy says of Anthem, the concept of something that was completely earthral, not contrived, like a walk through the forest, and nobody objected to it. You have to remember, the Grateful Dead is an anarchy. There weren't any bosses, and that was good and bad. Released as a 45 in April 1968 with a classy picture sleeve, Dark Star went right into a black hole, reportedly selling only 500 copies. Although Constantine says he heard it on the radio in Las Vegas while he was finishing his Air Force time. Dark Star was not included on Anthem of the Sun because, Lech said in 1984, it just moved too fast. Hunter made a spoken cameo at the end, reciting a passage about spinning stars and waxen wind. And Garcia is heard on banjo from an old tape of A Lesson. I was giving somebody in 62 or so, he told the British journal Swing 51. I threw it on the end of Dark Star just for the hell of it. Another letter landed in the Grateful Dead's mailbox in February 1969, this time on the letterhead of Hugh Hefner, editor and publisher of Playboy. In January, the band taped an appearance for Playboy After Dark, a TV series hosted by Hefner, and shot like an exclusive cocktail party. The seven-piece Dead, looking like they came from a holdup in Tijuana, played two songs from the unfinished AOXOMOXOA, Mountains of the Moon, a delicate ballad with prominent harpsichord flourishes by Constantine, and a roaring St. Stephen, McKernan as a third drummer on congas. As credits rolled, McKernan belted his party piece, Bobby Blue Bland, Turn On Your Love Light. In his note, Hefner thanked the Dead for having made the taping session as enjoyable to do as I think it will be to watch, alluding to an extra production touch. The Dead's crew dosed some of the libations with LSD, including Hefner's Pepsi. In 1972, when asked by Rolling Stone to define psychedelic music, Garcia replied by quoting Lech, "Acid rock is music you listen to when you're high on acid." AOXOMOXOA was made on different fuel. "We were sipping STP during our session," Garcia revealed, which made it a little weird. In fact, very weird. Also present, a 4-foot-tall tank of nitrous oxide with 8 hoses coming off of it, says Doug McNeese, an electronic composer who operated the Moog synthesizer used on AOXOMOXOA's crowning indulgence, What Became of the Baby. "They call it laughing gas for a reason," McGee points out cheerfully, "because everything is amusing." Then thoughtful, "But people would back out. I was seeing pluses and minuses and going, oh, that's what it all means," then hitting the floor. One AOXOMOA experiment under the influence, Barbed Wire Whipping Party, was a torrent of sounds and chatter that even Garcia called total gibberish. It remains unreleased, but available for testing on YouTube. If Anthem of the Sun was Lech's pursuit of the ideal Dead on vinyl, AOXOMOXOA was Garcia's white whale, almost to the exclusion of the band itself. In a November 1968 story headlined, "Has Frisco Gone Commercial?" the New York Times cited the expected fragmenting of the Grateful Dead, Ware and McKernan staying behind while the others moved deeper into electronics. It was a momentary breach. Ware is seen in studio photos from AOXOMOA playing guitar, but Rolling Stone's rave review in July 1969 harshly judged McKernan's diminished role on the record. The Dead were more magical and less definable without him. On the back cover, McKernan was credited as Pigpen Constantine, played all keyboards. At the center of it all was Garcia's voice, fragile and hermetic, in the ballad Miniature Rosemary and the starlit suspense of Mountains of the Moon, brighter and stronger, ringed in harmonies for St. Stephen and China Cat Sunflower, bereft and a cappella, swimming through dark Moog Rapids in What Became of the Baby. Stripped of its science, the song was a medieval lament, an epitaph for the fading utopia of the Dead's hometown. And here's a little bit of that song, What's Become of the Baby, by the Grateful Dead. Live, McKinney says of Garcia's vocal in that bleak piece, processed as he sang by McKinney with filters in the Moog, serial number 4 in Robert Moog's first line of synthesizers. The analogy is it's the inside of your mouth, and the controls are your tongue. Once it was recorded, it was possible to run it through various things. I don't remember, he admits, there was a lot of substance involved. Garcia and Hunter wrote the 8 songs on AOXOMOAXOA with Lech for St. Stephen. Some new tunes, as the guitarist told Rolling Stone, that I hadn't really bothered to teach anyone in the band. AOXOMOAXOA was done largely in overdubs. We didn't go about it as a group at all. And it was recorded twice on 8-track tape with a working title, Earthquake Country, to the end of 1968, then on 16-track when Pacific Recording in San Mateo got an Apex machine in that brand new format. 8-track work was scrapped. Garcia chose to start again. We would look to Jerry for what he wanted. The ideas he had, says guitarist David Nelson, an old friend and bandmate of Garcia from their bluegrass days. Nelson played background guitar on Rosemary, Mountains of the Moon, and Doing That Rag, and was in the Fillmore Beach Boys Choir for China Cat Sunflower. By the summer of 1969, Nelson, singer-guitarist John Marmaduke Dawson, another LP guest, and Garcia on pedal steel guitar, were gigging as psychedelic cowboys in New Riders of the Purple Sage. It was mostly a group of hippies, Nelson says, of AOXOMOAXOA, doing their thing, delighted with this new multi-track recording. We thought of ourselves as brats that got into a studio trying everything. But Garcia was attentive to detail. Peter Grant says Garcia sent him a tape of Doing That Rag to learn the tune before going to San Mateo to tape his pedal steel part. With its sliding time and jaunty chord changes, Grant says, it was the most complex song I've ever played. Recording went fine. Then Garcia called 2 days later. He says, Pete, you gotta come and do it again. Your part was a half fret off. AOXOMOXOA was barely underway the second time when engineers Bob Matthews and Betty Cantor Jackson carted that 16-track Apex from San Mateo to San Francisco to capture the Dead live at the Avalon Ballroom. "We hauled it up the back stairs," says Cantor Jackson, one of the most revered engineers in the Dead's history, for the clarity and force of her Betty boards in the 1970s. "We got a dynamic microphone into each track on the tape machine. No board, no nothing." With more recordings a month later from the Fillmore West, Matthews and Cantor Jackson compiled two LPs of material for the band's appraisal. "Everybody had something to say," she recalls, "but it was pretty much agreed about certain performances." Issued in November 1969, only 5 months after AOXOMOXOA, Live Dead sold well, lighting the balance sheet as Warner Brothers, recreating the era's nightly cycle from the winding sublime of Dark Star into the mystic with St. Stephen's and its whirlwind rhythm twin, the 11, then to McKinnon at his salacious best in Love Light. The album was everything the Dead wanted to bottle on the previous LPs. The unpredictable soaring and sharing with the listener and each other without the artifice and constraint of the studio. I always like to think of Grateful Dead music as electric chamber music, Lech said in 2014, the music of friends. Live Dead was also the end of a songbook. "We got so out there," Ware reflected in 2005, "we were pushing the limits of the patience of our audience." At the time when what was becoming popular was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, people who had tunes to offer. "We could all sing," he added, "but we needed songs." By February 1970, 3 months after Live Dead came out, the band was in Pacific High Recording, practically a home studio located a few blocks from the Fillmore West. Making its next album, Working Man's Dead, the Dead finished it in less than 2 weeks. Sunrise on Saturday, December 6, 1969, arrived on a long, beatific note, a 20-minute drone played by McKinnon on the Moog for the multitude already gathered at Altamont Speedway, east of San Francisco, for a free festival headlined by the Rolling Stones. McKinney brought the Moog along when he was asked to help set up in the sound system. The rest of the day went south, fast, a disaster of organization and rock god ego, with a murder in front of the Stones as they performed. The Dead, whose management worked with the Stones on the fateful issue of security by the Hells Angels, didn't play, leaving as the violence escalated. "Altamont was a wound on our culture," says Cantor Jackson, who worked the stage that day and recorded the Stones. "It was the first gathering of that many people in our city, estimated at 300,000, and somebody died." 2 weeks later, on December 20th, at the Fillmore Auditorium, near the end of the second set, the Dead debuted a song named after the field of battle, New Speedway Boogie, destined for Working Man's Dead. Garcia sang Hunter's Prayer in the chorus with uneasy optimism. "One way or another, this darkness got to give. Surrender was not an option." Here's a little bit of that song, New Speedway Boogie, by the Grateful Dead.
Please don't dominate the rap jack if you got nothing new to say. If you please don't back up the check, this train's got to run today. I spent a little time on the mountain, spent a little time on the hill. Heard some say better run away, others say better stand still. Now I don't know, but I've been told it's hard to run with the way to go. With the weight of lead.
A Long Strange Trip immortalized on 1970's American Beauty in the road memoir Truckin' had a quarter century to run for Garcia. It is still going on for those he left behind in and beyond the band. The Grateful Dead never made another studio album in the ballroom days image of Anthem of the Sun or the insular cryptic spirit of AOXOMOXOA. There was no need. We developed the engine, which generated a lot of energy, Weir said, of the ferment that peaked on Live Dead. Then we started working on ways to focus it without trying to focus it to death. And here's a little bit of that famous song, Truckin', by the Grateful Dead.
Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the doodah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin' on, on. Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. Your typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings. Dallas got a soft moon.
It was like a dialectic, Les suggested to me in 2014. Anthem of the Sun was the thesis. Working Man's Dead was the antithesis. Folk and country-rooted meditations on a counterculture under siege, but not to be denied. Everything that came after that was a kind of synthesis of those in varying degrees. Garcia retained a fondness for AOXOMOXOA, remixing the album for a 1971 re-release. There are certain feelings and a certain kind of looseness that I dig, he said in 1972. It was when Hunter and I were both being more or less obscure. A lot of levels on the verbal plane. The result was too far out for most people. Les remixed Anthem of the Sun for a 1971 reissue, but later called it a mistake. The original mix is a work of art. Dan Healy agrees. Stoned on acid, the engineer says, Anthem of the Sun makes perfect sense. More important, he insists, was the concept. The stretch out, breaking that record company's regimental mold. I can't tell you how many people said, you guys are gonna crash. You've just blown your whole thing. And we said, fuck, we can do this. And we did do it.
And I will read the article. And in June 1963, girl groups take over next week. So we have enough time for the classic album review, which this week is Nashville Skyline by Bob Dylan. And this week's album review is Nashville Skyline by Bob Dylan. While it may have confused a lot of people at the time of its release, 1969's Nashville Skyline turned out to be anything but a novelty record from Bob Dylan, sporting a voice that made him sound like Engelbert Humperdinck's slightly soused cousin, and flaunting a crack studio band that could make even the simplest compositions come to life, Dylan made country music filled with energy and warmth. the album became one of the most popular of his career and includes a few stone-cold classics for good measures. Here is a song-by-song review. So, this person gives 2 stars for this song, Nashville Skyline Rag. It's an in-depth examination of the insidious effects of smog on a typical southeastern American city, and just checking to see if you're paying attention, it's actually a peppy instrumental with a dueling instrument motif. 3 stars, Peggy Day. I made light of Bob's voice in the intro, but in truth, he really did develop quite an affecting croon for the album. Listen to the way he flitters through the bridge of this light-hearted song, and you'll see what I mean. And here's a little bit of the song Peggy Day from Nashville Skyline.
Peggy Day stole my poor heart away. By golly, what more can I say? Love to spend the night with Peggy Day. Peggy Night makes my future look so bright.
And another 3-star song, Country Pie. The recording is a bit of a wild scramble, but that's what makes it so much fun. Under 2 minutes, the song leaves just enough time for some of Dylan's most bizarre lyrics, which, with their food-centric theme, could be seen as a country cousin to the Beatles' Savoy Truffle. Here's a little bit of the song Country Pie from Bob Dylan.
Just like old saxophone Joe, when he's got the hog's head up on his toe. Oh, me, oh, my, love that country pie. Listen to the fiddler play, when he's playing till the break of day. Oh, me, oh, my.
And these are some 4-star songs, Girl from the North Country with Johnny Cash. So what if the harmonies are wonky and the pair aren't always singing the same lyrics? The song itself is unaccessible and leads itself well to the duet format, while the emotion that both men bring to the table makes it clear that this wasn't just a pair of stars mailing in a duet. This was Dylan and Cash, a mutual admiration society, bringing out the best in each other. And here's a little bit of that song, Girl from the North Country.
If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
See for me that her hair's hanging down. It curls and falls all down her breast.
And here's a 5-star song, Lay Lady Lay. Never before has Dylan been so direct with his declarations of ardor as on this big hit song. As a result, Lay Lady Lay cast a sensual ambience that is embellished by the music. Kenny Buttrey's bongo and cowbell combination work in spite of itself, and the hazy organ in the audio equivalent of candlelight. Bob's vocal is as charming as it is randy. The urgency of the melody in the bridge makes plain the intensity of his desire. Maybe Dylan's sexiest song ever. And here's a little bit of that song, Lay Lady Lay.
lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big brass bed. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big brass bed. Whatever colors you have in your mind.
In the last five-star song, I Threw It All Away. If Nashville Skyline is Dylan's ultimate homage to Hank Williams, then consider this song his I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, as both are majestically woeful. As if it isn't bad enough that he has lost the love of his life, the narrator here has to spend his weary days knowing that he himself was to blame for her departure. Here's a little bit of that song, I Threw It All Away, by Bob Dylan.
I once held her in my arms. She said she would always stay. But I was cruel, I treated her like a fool. I threw it all away.
And once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to read the article I didn't get to this week, June 1963, Girl Groups Take Over, and then the Mojo interview with the Stranglers, Jean Jacques Burnell, and a classic album review of Blue Album by Weezer. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rockin'.
Lay across my big brass bed. Stay, lady, stay.